Ely had selected him because he, like all the black Irish O'Banions, was deeply, irrevocably flawed. Still, she'd have chosen him. Her childhood confidant, her lover, her soulmate. Jealousy, a twisted emotion she'd never felt in her sweet Sean, had thundered so violently in his heart it terrified her. This wasn't her best friend. The man she knew nearly as well as she knew herself. He'd said,
"I can't accept that. I need to know."
"What difference could it make?" she'd said wearily. "Would you be asking me to give up the child if it's not yours? Do you think we can just send it back? Is that what you want of me? It's my child, too."
Either he could love them both or he couldn't. By then, a mother's love had awakened, fierce and protective. She could feel the life within her, tiny and lovely. She'd already resolved her struggle. If the child were Cruz's, there were two options. Kill it, which was no option at all, or give it away, which was no option at all. It was half of her, and if the worst were true, the child could have no mother better than Kat. Another woman would have no idea what she was raising. Her only choice was to trust in the power of love, a love Sean clearly didn't feel. She hadn't seen him for over 2 years. She ached to see him. She struggled to not think about him, to not think about many things.
"Evening, Kat," Enyo said, dropping down in a tufted chair next to her, kicking her legs over the side. The tawny-skinned soldier nudged the butt of her gun, tucked in a hip holster to keep it from digging into her ribs, and slid her automatic, suspended by a band across her chest, over the arm of the chair. Dagger hilts gleamed, tucked into her boots. Enyo was a crack shot, sniper or close range, responsible for training all the women at the Abbey that wanted to learn. None were pressured. Still, all eventually came.
"Good evening, Enyo," Kat replied with a smile that wasn't returned. But Enyo rarely smiled. Energy thrummed beneath her skin. Intelligence flashed in her dark eyes. Though Kat would never voice them, it wasn't her place. She knew some of the woman's secrets. They were painful, and had made her the hardened warrior she was. Born inside a military tank under heavy fire, war was where Enyo Luna thrived. As the rest of the Shidon filed in, Kat focused outward, lowering her guards, assessing the room. Her gift gave her many unfair advantages. She used them. There were 8 members of the Shidon. Herself, the fierce French-Lebanese Enyo, the ethereal Rhiannon from Wales, whose specialty was shattering wards and neutralizing spells, quiet Arena from Derrynane, County Kerry, who could commune with animals of every kind, sharp-edged Ciara from Ulster East, with her wildfire magic, Colleen McKelter from Scotland, who over the past 2 years had become, under one of her uncle's tutelage, an expert in the druid arts, the lovely, aloof, chocolate-skinned Duff from their powerful Boston sister house, who possessed a terrible gift, and the cynical, jaded Decla, who traveled the world with a military father and who possessed far darker she-seer talents than she owned up to. These women were the new rule. Duff and Decla took a bit more time to assess than the others, but Kat ruthlessly scanned each of them in turn, assessing, seeking rotten spots in the shiniest of their apples. She found none. Tonight. But maintained eternal awareness that one day, her elegant, brutal invasion might fail to yield such happy results. Perhaps even with her own daughter. The song of making had changed everything. War was coming. There was no doubt of it. Sides would be taken. None of them black and white. There were acres and acres of gray as far as she could see, evidenced by changes even on their estate. 6 months ago,
A cast of tiny spurshi had taken up residence in the Abbey's gardens and labyrinth. They were as simple and kind as could be, lovingly nurturing the foliage, openly seeking the she-seers, pledging their loyalty, eschewing their own race, outcast by them, begging sanctuary to live among humans. Initially, Kat had feared they were spies, but she turned her gift on the tiny sprites and found them as pure and simple as the dawn. Earth elementals, a type of fae she'd never imagined existed. Good ones. Though she'd been horrified to discover them capable of reproduction, there was one fae name she never permitted herself to think. A name Ray would never know. He was dead. There was no reason to know, and no need for a paternity test. Time would tell. "Any luck?" she asked the room as the women settled in armchairs and sprawled on divans. A dozen of their she-seers, adepts, had gone missing. Duff said grimly, "Not yet. We combed Temple Bar from end to end, and we plan to fan out into the outskirts tonight. Declan and I went into Illyrium, tried to ask around. But if you're not willing to fuck Faye," she spat with a dark scowl, "you get nothing but suspicion in that club. I don't know how they survived their shifts there." "They knew it was necessary," Kat said, with no small measure of regret. "We sent only volunteers." The 12 were spies, mature women, adepts, sent into Illyrium because the Shedon had finally unanimously agreed they could no longer go on without gathering intelligence on the state of the Fae court. For 2 long years they'd waited and prepared, giving the Fae wide berth, never going near them, as Mac had demanded. But rumors had been growing that the Fae had changed. And how could they hope to prepare for a war if they didn't know their enemy? The team had gone in with full awareness of what they were getting into, what was being asked of them. They'd been working the shift for a week, and each morning, when they returned from having sex with the Fae, Kat had used her gift on each in turn, painfully aware of how ruthlessly, overwhelmingly seductive the Fae could be. To a woman, their dozen she-seer spies at Illyrium had remained true. Night after night, they'd let their bodies be used, while protecting their minds, mining for tidbits of information, had sunk to the depths necessary to infiltrate the club while holding on to their essential selves. And for so little gain. All they'd been able to tell the Shedon thus far was that the Fae were definitely more powerful, to degrees unknown, definitely changed by the song, but there was an inner circle of High Fae, cloistered deep within their own private club, to which a highly select few were ever granted access. None of the 12 had yet gained an invitation. Now they were gone. All of them. Vanished without a trace. They'd left for the club, as usual, Saturday evening, and failed to return Sunday at dawn. They'd been missing for 2 days now, and she feared the worst.
"What did Danny say?" Colleen asked. "Has she had any luck searching for them?"
"I didn't tell her they were missing for the same reason we agreed not to tell her we were sending spies in. Had she known, she'd have insisted on accompanying them. If she knew they were missing, she'd storm into Illyrium, demanding answers at the tip of a sword. We all know what outcome that would have."
Enyo said,
"Our oath to the Fae Queen would be broken. That sword is part of Danny's soul. She can't not kill Fae. The only way she's managed it this long, and kept her word to Mac, is because she won't allow herself to go anywhere near them."
"Precisely. That's why we can tell her nothing. Continue your search. Continue your silence."
Nodding, the Shedon rose, and prepared to head back into the city to find their missing sisters.
"Mummy, why are the Fae bad?"
Ray said later, as Kat tugged off her shoes and began to run her bath.
"Not all of them are," she replied absently,
mulling the day's events with half her mind. She realized what she was doing and forced herself to put away the Abbey's business for a time. Her daughter deserved her full attention, a thing she'd never known from her own mother. She'd been deemed a worthless implement by both her parents. Handicapped with such extreme empathy, she'd seemed broken, even insane as a child. Ray was her world, an unexpected gift, a treasure she would forever cherish, protect, and love, and do all in her power to raise well. The love of a child from her own flesh was the purest an empath could know. Her daughter had been slow to start talking, but given her own childhood, that hadn't concerned her. Then suddenly, a month ago, Ray had begun blurting words she'd no idea her daughter even understood, stringing them together into impressive sentences.
"The Spurshi like me," Ray announced happily. "They say I smell good to them."
Cat froze, her hand tightening on the edge of the antique enameled clawfoot tub in their suite.
"Did they say what you smell like?"
Ray shook her head, black curls bouncing, eyes dancing merrily.
"Just that I'm yummy. They smell yummy to me, too."
"Like what?" Cat asked. Ray nibbled her lower lip and thought, then scrubbed at her nose and laughed.
"It tickles my nose. Just good."
Pollen, Cat thought. Many of the tiny fae, banished from their own court, lived tucked inside human blossoms, made homes in fragrant herb-drenched thickets and nests in piney glades. Lately, some of the she-seers had taken to building diminutive wooden houses for them, painted bright colors. She'd half expected the earthy Spurshi to protect the human-like structures, but the other day she'd watched a couple, they made it for life, battle a surprised hostile sparrow at their door, protecting their new abode.
"Come, love, your bath is ready."
"Bubbles?"
"Not tonight, only on hair-washing nights." Ray's hair was so thick and curly, it was a chore to wash. They only did it every third night, and then bubbles in her bath were her reward for the time she had to sit while Cat detangled her hair.
"Mummy,"
Ray said,
"my back itches. I can't reach it."
Smiling, Cat held out her arms, and when Ray stepped into them, snuggling to her chest, she tugged her daughter's shirt off over her head.
"It itches bad."
"Turn around and let me see it, pumpkin," Cat said.
"I'm not a pumpkin. Today I'm a dragonfly."
"Well then, little Miss Dragonfly, turn."
But Ray had already turned and bent forward.
"Mummy,"
she huffed.
"Itch."
"Did you lay on something today?"
"I always lay on things."
"Like what? Rocks? Something sharp?"
"Just things, grass and stuff."
"But there might have been rocks in the grass."
"Don't remember any. Itch."
Cat raised a hand that trembled only slightly and scratched her daughter's beautiful, smooth skin that was so much like Sean's. Fair, yet with the slightest sun it turned golden. There were two identically sized, round, pink blemishes. One on each shoulder. 13. Raise a little hell. Raise a little hell. Raise a little hell. I wake up grumpy and discombobulated most of the time, unless I'm under attack. Then I wake up sleek, cool, and lethal. Lack of pressure turns me into a high-velocity ping-pong ball that bounces off anything it encounters. Adversity molds my finest shape. Today was a disturbing anomaly. I woke feeling bright, focused, alert, more well-rested than I could recall being in years. Something was definitely wrong. I snatched my sword, vaulted from bed, and spun in a tight circle, seeking intruders. There were none. I was alone in my bedroom, and the beast was gone. I forfeited a split second of situational awareness to seething about that, then resumed analyzing my inexplicably fine mood. There was no other explanation for it. There had to be a threat somewhere in my flat. I set to clearing every room, closet and cubby. Nothing. I headed back to my room to search it a second time, and as I crossed the threshold, I felt it. I would have noticed it the first time, but high alert focuses me like a laser on potential intruders, not innocuous doorways. I glanced down, squinting, peering in a sideways, I'm not really looking, fashion. Wards can be tricky to see, especially good ones, and this was exquisite. A slate so dark it was nearly indistinguishable from the black marble threshold into which it was carved. The ward had 7 distinct layers of design, painstakingly embedded atop each other, plus the softly shimmering hint of 2 more layers I couldn't make out. The more intently I studied them, the more elusive they became, shifting into indistinct designs. Oh yes, damn fine wards. Protected by a spell of obscurity to prevent them from being duplicated, the mark of a true artisan. It took blood, sweat, and time to work such a spell into cold marble, plus skill I don't possess. I moved to the windows, located the same wards at each sill. The beast had draped his version of a well-worn quilt around me before he'd left. I recognized the elaborate symbols and runes. They're etched at thresholds of Baron's books and baubles, and there isn't a fairy in all existence that can cross them. Possibly not even Mag. Unless he wove it with an exception for her, which would have required her blood as well. Did that mean my cruelly starved visitor was Jericho Baron's? And if so, where did he go, and why? What did he think my flat was? A convenient stop-and-go where he could pop in unannounced, get fed, then go tearing off without a word? Thinking to appease me with the gift of a few wards? Don't get me wrong, I was grateful for them. I'm incapable of working such formidable magic myself. Their presence made Sanctuary infinitely more valuable to me. I now had a flat with a room that was safe from the sifting fae who could simply appear smack in the middle of any of my flats, if they felt so inclined. But I didn't want wards. I'd survived just fine without them for 2 years. I wanted answers. I wanted my beast back. I wanted to no longer be the only supercar revving my engine in Dublin. I wanted the entire primal fleet of growling, high-performance Lambos and Ferraris and big black badass military Humvees making thunder in the streets of my city. Besides, I pretty much convinced myself the beast was Riordan. Not from a wealth of empirical data, but an unshakable gut feeling. I'd thought he'd stay. I'd wake up and find him here. We'd catch up, get mad at each other. It'd be like old times. Not. My bright, alert, true north-pointing mood took a steep nosedive south. Fuming, I stalked into the bathroom, muttering beneath my breath. I'd lived 2 long years without a single glimpse of the Nine, and when I finally got one of them back, he'd snuck off while I was sleeping, after everything I'd done for him. Okay, never a houseguest, but if I was, I'd offer both a hello and a goodbye, especially if my host had saved my life. The Nine drive me batshit crazy. Still, the beast might be floating around Dublin somewhere. After brushing my teeth and scraping my tangled hair back into a messy ponytail, not about to brush it, time was of the essence. I tugged on black combat pants and stuffed the many zippered pockets and pouches with weapons, then tucked my Glock in my waistband. I fastened a belt around my waist that became 3 different weapons, and hooked a choker at my neck that became a 4th. Slid on a cuff that concealed razors. I pulled on a long-sleeved shirt and boots, gloved up, duct-taped my neck, slid my sword over my back, and headed for the kitchen to gulp down protein and fat while scanning my text messages. As I hurried for the door, I called out to Shazam, telling him to catch up with me ASAP, that I loved and missed him, and would enormously appreciate his extraordinarily acute sense of smell that was so vastly superior to mine, and would he please join me on an adventure today?
His recent long absences were really worrying me. Then, with thunder in my step that held belligerence I didn't bother to conceal, I exploded into the fog-kissed Dublin morning. Woman on a mission. Hunt. Beast. I prowled the streets, scanning my surroundings up, down and sideways, sniffing the air, listening intently, while tallying my priorities for the day. Rainey had texted while I was sleeping, letting me know she'd found a home, not only for Sarah Brady and her siblings, but two other orphaned families. No children were placed until I inspected their new homes myself. I won't save innocents only to lose them to another's corruption. In my teens, I'd have also prepped a Danny Daily about recent events, but Dublin had a paper again, and these days, I merely jotted notes, snapped photos, and left the info outside their offices down by the O'Connell post office. They'd proven reliable about printing the things I considered important, so I stuck to my gracious non-compete. I didn't get a byline, but at least the news got out there. Also on my list was book shopping. Since my bookstore of choice, with its kick-ass motto, "You want it, we've got it, and if we don't, we'll find it," was MIA, I was going to have to patronize Bain's Bibliotheque and Bagels. Seriously, copy much? Get your own original thought. With its concrete floors, stark fluorescent lights, dog-eared, smelly, second-hand, overpriced books, and even more overpriced cafe. The euro still ruled, second to brute force and black market racketeering. Dublin had quickly relapsed into that elaborate conspiracy of pretending meaningless pieces of paper were worth something, which worked for me. I'd pilfered a pile of currency I found stashed in a storage room deep in Chester's. One of 10 storage rooms, crammed with currency from too many countries to count. Much of it intriguingly ancient. Though cell towers functioned reliably for the most part, the internet was in sad shape, vast chunks of it missing. With so much of the human race gone, enormous areas of the planet lacked both the power and manpower to run things. Compounded by magic making things unpredictable, books once again commanded a premium. I needed information about Ireland's gods and goddesses. I'd never given them much of a thought. I preferred superheroes, and had spent far more time poring over comics and graphic novels. Who was Oz, and what was his modus operandi for tripping people up with their own wishes? While uncovering their legends, perhaps I'd stumble across a story about a god that had long ago been wont to abduct adults, leaving their children behind. Discover the why of it, a name, a way to defeat him. Granted, a contemporary book wouldn't yield nearly the detailed information of the Abbey's private libraries, but it was as good as a place to start as any. Beast first. I decided, even though BB&B was gone, to head straight there. Not only was it closer, but the wards were decidedly Baron's-esque. Perhaps both owner and establishment had miraculously reappeared. One could always hope. Besides, when I discovered it missing the other day, I'd not scouted the lots with my customary attention to detail, aggravated by its disappearance and on the trail of prey. If BB&B yielded nothing, I'd head straight for Chester's. As I moved briskly across Apenny Bridge and entered the south side of Dublin, I encountered my second anomaly of the day. It was Saturday, but this morning at 7:30, the streets teemed with people in suits and dresses who looked suspiciously as if they were going to work. As a pedestrian ploughed down the sidewalk toward me, a woman in her late 20s or early 30s who was peering intently down at her cell phone, I said politely, "Pardon, what day is it?" She raised her head, absorbed me, noting the hilt of my sword poking over my shoulder, the many bulges in my pockets. Perhaps she just didn't like my face. Her eyes narrowed, she clutched her purse more tightly and darted around me, sprinting off in high heels. I glared at her retreating back. "Right, because monsters don't exist, and you don't need people like me in the world," I muttered as I reached for my phone. When I'd read my text messages earlier, I hadn't paid any attention to the date. There'd been no reason to. I sleep a few hours at most and can go days without it. But yesterday was a bit more eventful and I'd slept closer to 4 hours. I gaped down at the screen. It was Tuesday. I shook it, hard. It still said Tuesday. That was impossible. I narrowed my eyes as the tatters of a dream I'd had last night, or rather days ago, surfaced in my mind. Riodin, tracing symbols on me, murmuring. That prick. I'd awakened feeling so unusually fine because he'd spelled me into sleeping from Friday night until Tuesday morning. Bristling, I pivoted sharply and stormed in the opposite direction, crossing Barron's off my suspect list. Riordan had used his powers of relaxation on me in the past. This was a Machiavellian move, taking me out of the game so he could leave Dublin on his own timetable. If Riordan wasn't at Chester's, I was wrecking the place. Trashing. Maybe torching. No, I wasn't done searching it, but definitely wrecking. Nobody knocks me out for days. Especially not after being gone for 2 years. Especially not after I saved his ass. As I stalked toward 939 Revmal Street, my brain processed a third anomaly. An inordinate number of blue-collar workers, labourers from the looks of them, were marching in the same direction, belts swaying heavy with tools. They were bright-eyed, ruddy-cheeked, talking loudly with excitement. I moved in behind the fast-moving throng to eavesdrop.
"I heard there's a year's work. Maybe more,"
one of the men exclaimed.
"I heard too. Christ, that'd be something. Bollocks. It's good to be working again. The construction business has been deader than a bloody doornail. Too many buildings. Not enough people to fill a tenth of them. Nice to see someone willing to put the money into new construction. Right that, with folks worrying about what tomorrow might bring."
Part of me was pleased by this turn of events. Someone was building, making jobs for those who had none. Electricians, plumbers, specialty skills were still in demand. But builders, men that cut lumber and hung drywall, metal workers, men who tiled and framed, simply weren't needed anymore. No one was building anything new, and probably wouldn't for a long time. It wasn't as if these men could get additional training to learn a more useful skill. We were back to low or no-wage apprenticing, a long way from staffing universities again. There was too much unrest, a deep unease about the future. We were a society fractured in countless ways. Those gainfully employed filled essential positions. Food production, crucial technology, law enforcement, news. Jobs were hard to find. Hence the high rate of crime in our city. And it got a lot worse the farther out you went.
"Who's funding the project?"
a newcomer to the conversation said.
"What's his name? Bugger, it's right on the tip of my tongue. Weird name. Reardon? Same guy that turned things around a few years back, when those black holes were everywhere and we were running out of food. Got the papers out. Put the city back on track. He's been gone a while. Glad to hear he's back. We could use more men like him around this city."
I scowled. A bigger part of me was distinctly not pleased. I'd been here, humping the grind every day for the past 2 years, working tirelessly to save my city. And what did I get? Scowled at and run away from, merely for asking a polite question. My hands fisted and my frown deepened. I was willing to bet half the money I'd stolen from Riordan that these ebullient, newly employed men were headed for Chester's. And if my suspicion was correct, that person in the premier spot on my shit list this morning, that pain in my ass who hadn't been doing a bloody thing to help Dublin for the past 2 years, was about to get sainted by my city again.
14. Cockroaches slithered in stone-dusted crevices, under and over rocks, reassembling beyond a jagged outcropping, deep in shadow, into a squat, gelatinous body with two legs, six arms, and a small head with a beak-like mouth. His fragile, uncertain form disgusted the roach god. He craved a solid existence among men, or at the least, a return to the lofty position he'd once enjoyed. When Titans warred, it wasn't the giants that survived. It was those who made themselves small and inconspicuous that passed beyond their enemies' regard. At this, the one called Papa Roach by mortals excelled. He'd been the insects beneath humans' feet, reviled, assaulted merely for poaching small morsels of food for longer than he cared to recall. Modern man found him grotesque and, with caustic, corrosive chemicals, drove him from their bright world into the darkness of foundations, walls, caves, and sewers. Turned him into a creature of furtive stealth and petty displays of scratching his back on their toothbrushes while they slept, spitting into their glasses, smearing small crusts of feces along the rims, dropping more in their utensil drawers. His beggarly amusements, they shared their world with him whether they wanted to or not, whether they knew it or not. The darkness was his. His exploits began when theirs ended in sleep. In his venerable prime, his countless bodies, their enviable endurance, agility, and ability to penetrate the most secret places, had been much acclaimed and sought after. He'd been respected, feared, admired, his counsel deemed invaluable. Women had put out food for him at each meal, beseeching his presence beneath their table, preparing tempting dishes to entice him near so they might importune his aid. There had been a time he'd benevolently assisted them, enjoyed them, cared. No more. By the blood of the she, what did they expect? When you treated things badly, things behaved badly. Who was inclined to seize moments of persecution to demonstrate their finest nature? Idiots. Fools. He'd been there from the first, long before the fairy, had watched humans make their first slithering passage onto solid ground, had applauded them as they'd evolved, become more. Now they were so much less. Glistening mandibles ground together as he rubbed shiny black carapace against carapace to grate in a hiss. "My name is Gustane." It had been thousands of years since he'd said the words, since he'd called himself anything but Roach. The Titans had fallen, most forever slain. The rare few, the impossible to kill, perhaps 100 of them, imprisoned in the earth. The handful of gods who had both survived the catastrophic wars and escaped imprisonment had, like him, found a way to hide. Gustane enjoyed an intimacy with the planet few gods knew. He, who had once dined on the finest the world had to offer, now subsisted on its refuse, burrowed deep in its septic waste, had come to relish the diverse flavors of shit for the knowledge it afforded him. He could taste the sickness in human offal, knew what disease was killing them. In days of yore, he might have fetched them the right herb, root, or oil to correct the imbalance. Rot faster, he cursed them now. Blow yourselves up. Kill your race off and get out of my way. He'd even burrowed of late, beneath human skin, dining on the succulent fat of their bodies, nestled within them, privy to many of their thoughts and feelings. He crept anywhere and everywhere, knew all their secrets, yet lacked the power to do a damn thing with it. Merely shaping himself into a form that could communicate was taxing. His arms and legs tended to crumble into individual segments if overexerted. Yet, the timeless melody had been sung, and it had changed the world, waking some things, killing others, but most dazzling of all, giving rise to the possibility of a new order that might restore the position he'd once enjoyed, elevate him from the gutters and sewers and endless attacks that were his existence. The earth felt the same as it once had to him, over 1 million years ago. The ancient song had not, however, improved or altered him in any way. The imperviousness of the cockroach ran deep into his insectile core. Virtually indestructible, he alone remained unchanged by the relentless march of time, by the magic that waxed, waned and waxed anew. He was, as far as he knew, the sole exception, the obdurate Gustain. He pledged his allegiance to a few during his darkest times, a half-mad witch from the Caspian Mountains, a dead man who had risen to hunt the night, an ancient primal beast that was neither god nor fairy, but possessed the Landu, the hated black blade that could destroy him, and finally, recently allying himself with a prince of the very race that had corrupted and crushed his. With his brothers and sisters gone, he no longer cared who held power, so long as he had a share. But now one of his own was back, and strong enough to merit attention, powerful enough to reclaim the Landu and free him, and from what he'd witnessed thus far, quite possibly capable of becoming deadly enough to eradicate the fairy from their world. Gustain dispersed his many bodies, reclaiming and molding them into a misshapen head atop one of the many corpses littering the stifling cavern, with its glowing rocks and bonfires, and watched the great god command his legion of worshippers. The great soul-stealer, Baylor, had returned. The gods had been tricked by their fairy enemies, deceived, manipulated, and crushed, but they'd lacked advantages they now possessed. Assets Baylor had already begun to exploit, as evidenced by a recent acquisition. 12 women, many of them badly beaten, chained to a column near his altar. Even now, a slim, dark aperture rippled near the towering dark god who had once been worshipped more devoutly, and with more terror than any of the others, as he stripped still more human souls from their bodies, increasing in power with each one he claimed. Once, the gods had cared about humans. That affection had been destroyed long ago. This time things would be different. This time, the gods would win. Unlike Gustain, Baylor had changed, as had his method of exploiting his, he chuckled dryly at the pun, god-given gift. And why not? With such enormous power, it was a wonder he'd ever been kind. He'd watched long enough. This was the master he would serve, a gargantuan, ruthless deity who shared his own grievances, goals, and desires, who'd already begun drawing other powerful gods near, as even now the devilish, bloodthirsty, wish-granting Oz danced devious attendance. Baylor had a plan, and a fine one. Gustain was more than ready to see the human race wiped out, and when it was, Baylor would be powerful enough to kill even the fairy. Gustain scattered into a sea of insects, scuttling over the grooves and crevices, making his way across the enormous cavern in a dark, glistening wave. He approached the god, where he stood near the black mirror and mound of bodies. Though many were maimed, they were not beyond repair or prolonged use. He waited respectfully while Baylor finished removing the paralysis spell from a tumble of bodies before assembling a precarious form and grinding out a formal trough. "I am at your service, great and powerful Baylor." The immense god whirled from the bodies in a rustle of long black robes, his limp barely noticeable. "Ah, yes, he was stronger than before." Half his magnificent face curved in a blindingly beautiful smile. The other half was completely concealed behind an elaborately embellished glossy raven mask. As he glanced down at the roach god's squat form, he laughed. "Ah, Gustain, my dear old friend, I'd hoped you'd survived and would find me here. Your skills have always been invaluable." "It is a pleasure to see you," Gustain said. "How may I serve?" One day he would never say those words again. "Oz has just apprised me of a human who has something that should belong to me. Scour Dublin and find her." "I would be honored to aid your cause.
Who do I seek?
Oz will give you the description. When you locate her, return to me with her location. Take no action. I will collect this body myself.
Have you a name?
Gustain eavesdropped everywhere, on everyone, invisible at their feet, in crevices and refuse. A name would help.
She calls herself Danny O'Malley.
15. I'm awfully underrated, but came here to correct it. Sure enough, the bastard was rebuilding Chester's. I stood on the sidewalk, hands fisted, a muscle working in my jaw, assaulted by such acute duality that I'd locked my limbs to keep them from ripping me apart, as they attempted to obey polar opposite desires. Conflicted is not my natural state. I'm an arrow to the goal, focused, unwavering. I pick a side and stick with it where every single facet of my life is concerned. Except for one. That man. Half of me wanted to punch my fist into the air and shout, "Bloody hell, my sidekick's back, and it looks like he plans to stick around for a while this time," while I dashed below to confirm the auspicious event with my own eyes. The other half of me wanted to slam my fist into Riordan's face and break bones. No, I reevaluated my percentages. Half wasn't quite right. 38% of me was in favor of caving to an idiotically happy smile, while 62% of me was incensed, infuriated, enraged, with thick plumes of steam threatening to erupt from my ears. I don't get headaches often, but I was about to have one. There was too much pressure in my body and no way to vent it. While he'd kept me out of commission without my consent, he'd made mind-boggling progress. A frame structure now stood on the previously empty lot above Chester's underground nightclub. Several hundred workers were rushing to and fro, prepping for the next phase of the project. Footers had been poured and were curing. There were steel beams and girders waiting to be placed. Bobcats growled. There was even a small crane maneuvering stuff around. Here, piles of lumber rested on pallets. There, enormous blocks of smoky stone were stacked high. He had to be running three shifts a day, working through the night. Riordan was like that. Once he wanted something, he wanted it yesterday. He'd wait if he had to, with the true patience of an immortal, but if he could bypass the waiting, he would. Why now? His bloody club had been wrecked years ago, and he'd not once made any effort to rebuild the facade above ground. What message was I supposed to take away from this? You may have worn yourself out helping Dublin for two long, solitary years, but I've gained their fealty in a mere matter of days? Not that I thought he was doing it to mess with me, which, given how much he used to mess with me, would have been a fair assumption. But I no longer think everything he does is about me. Still, my super ears were picking up way too many compliments about him.
Hey, miss. Miss!
A man said behind me. I ignored him. I was no doubt in his way, and he wanted me to move so I wouldn't delay a single second of the great Riordan's planned recreation of the world, which the Bible of Dublin would soon be rewritten to immortalize.
Miss, is that you? I thought it was.
The man circled around, stopping in front of me. Plucking his cap from his head, he stood, clutching it in his hands, a warm smile creasing his ruddy face.
Nobody else with that sword. Top of the morn to you, me dear. The missus keeps asking if I seen you again. She'd like you to join us for supper of an evening.
I retrieved his name from my mental files. Connor O'Connor. Some parents should be shot on naming day. After I'd visited them 6 months back, I'd approved Rainey placing 8-year-old Aaron with the middle-aged couple who'd lost their children when the walls fell. I managed to unclench my jaw, but forcing a smile was out of the question. My bones were connected by two tight rubber bands. Nodding tightly, I said, "That'd be lovely, thank you. I'll drop by when I can. How's Aaron?"
"The wee lass is fine as can be. She still has the occasional bad dream, but they're fewer and further between."
"Wonderful. I knew she'd be happy with you." I still couldn't unclench my hand, so I jerked a fist at the commotion. "What's the plan here?
How many stories?
At least half a dozen, I hear. But I've not seen the plans. The boss is below. You might ask him. I hear he's got an eye for the ladies, and a beauty like you could dazzle him into telling you anything.
He winked at me. His opinion and reality were clearly suffering massive disconnect. Answers from Riordan? As if. Beauty like me? I had duct tape on my neck, a scowl embedded in every muscle in my body, and I hadn't even brushed my hair.
Well then, Miss Danny, I'll be leaving you to your business, but I'm hoping you'll find time to drop by. You changed our lives, gave my missus her sparkle back, and when that woman's happy, my world's right as rain. There'll always be a seat for you at our table, and my Maggie's a fine cook.
Blushing, he tucked his chin down in a nod of sorts and ambled away. An eye for the ladies? That was pretty much all my brain retained. If Riordan was nodding from the top of his arrogant, womanizing staircase again, I was going to saw his head off. I had no idea why, and didn't care. I just would. Hands fisted, jaw clenched, I sped across the lot in half freeze frame, adroitly navigating machinery and men, to the door in the ground that led to Chester's below, and began my descent into hell, to raise some of my own.
16. I feel stormy weather moving in. It's raining men. As the shiny new steel trap door closed behind me on its shiny new hydraulic arm, I descended the also new stairs that had replaced the clumsy ladder once welded to the wall. As a teen, I'd watched the Seawin Fairy girls in their skin-tight short skirts paired with insanely high heels navigate that tricky ladder with a derisive snort, thinking, please wear panties. The stairs were a definite improvement. There used to be two sets of trapdoors and two ladders before you reached the foyer of Chester's below. That was no longer the case. The entry must have been the first thing Riordan set his crew to modifying. The foyer was now a single mammoth vestibule, with a long, elegantly curved staircase framed in enough to use, but not yet finished, that ended on a black marble floor so highly polished it served as an obsidian mirror. I clenched my hands so tightly, I nearly broke my own fingers. He'd clearly admired the floors of my flat, and copied them. New colossal double doors soared 20 feet, made of thick matte black steel, embellished with fantastical panels of wrought iron twisted into complex designs, undoubtedly laced with wards ready to be activated at a moment's notice. Ultra-modern charcoal consoles, inlaid with onyx, and a dozen white leather and chrome chairs graced the perimeter of the foyer. I stalked across the room and shoved the massive doors open with a scowl. I had to put my shoulder into it, which meant the average human would need to be let in from the other side. I stood between the parted doors for a long moment, breathing deep and slow, taking in the view. Interior lights blazed the entire width and breadth of the mini-terraced club. And there was that duality again. Chester's was lit, competing with, what else did that bastard copy of mine? I too had white leather and chrome chairs in my foyer next to my charcoal console. I'd stolen them from some rich guy's penthouse. I enjoy decorating because I'd never gotten to do it before, and I see things in structures and patterns, and decorating is a way of arranging things to achieve maximum visual happiness. If his kitchen had been remodeled with my counters and backsplash, he was dead. Death might be brief for him, but temporary was enough to make me feel better. Urban sophistication wed to industrial muscle, Chester's was London haute couture, slumming with Irish mob in the best possible way. The club was divided into countless tiered sub-clubs that would soon be filled to overflowing again. When the world goes to hell, people party. They need to. Who am I kidding? I need to. It spring cleans my brain, refreshes it like a blast of detritus-removing sanitizer. The days look brighter, saner,
after you've spent a night pretending the world hasn't gone mad and that you're on top of it. Especially if you finish it off on top of a worthy man, too. Not that I've had any luck finding one of those since Dancer. Dancer. Hole in my heart that never goes away. I miss him always, especially when I'm in a location owned by a man he and I used to conspire against together endlessly. I'd once despised Chester's. Convicted Riordan of catering to the wrong clientele. I see the place differently now. As an asset. The nightclub being reopened would give people a choice. Illyrium was the only club in town packed to the gills with dangerous thrills. Its appeal? The lethally exotic, sexually combustive Fae with their illusion, lies, and false offers of immortality. But Chester's would offer an equally seductive draw. The immortal, basely sexual, mysterious, ferociously Alpha 9. And if a few unseelie princes like Christian McElter and Sean O'Banion started hanging around again, Chester's would obliterate Illyrium. I'd even let Inspector Jane in. He'd be a significant lure. And the more humans that came to party here, the more Fae from Illyrium would come sniffing around, drawn by the banquet of mortal prey. Why was that good? We'd have control again. We'd know what was going on. People get drunk and tongues wag in clubs. They reveal things they shouldn't. The disadvantage of being banned from Illyrium was the only info I'd ever been able to obtain on the current state of Fairy came from people I questioned on the streets, and few were willing to tell me a bloody thing. I'd begun to suspect my picture hung in Illyrium's bathrooms with a block-lettered caption, "Do not talk to this bitch or we'll kill you." With the exception of Jane, I hadn't seen hide nor hair of Fae in, good grief, over a year? They were studiously avoiding me, for which I'd been grateful, given the perpetually itchy state of my sword hand. Oh, yes. I got it now. Offer to host your enemies. Let them misbehave. Pass no judgment. Yes, there's a price for it. You have to watch prey get preyed upon, but, and it's a critical but, chance favors the prepared mind. Intimate knowledge of the enemy prepares. I'm all about increasing odds of success where the human race is concerned. I saw Chester's now as I'd never been able to see it before. A vast, complicated, ever-shifting, treacherous, necessary chessboard. The White Army was definitely going to lose pawns. Nothing could be done about that. But their loss might gain the Black King's head and checkmate the war. The moment White got distracted, trying to protect pawns, the Black Army would go in for the kill and take White's king. I glanced down at the dance floors, to the elegant, wide, glass and chrome staircase that swept up to one of the many private, never accessible by public, levels of the club, where Riordan's glass office was located. In spite of my pissy mood, I smiled. Fade and Castillo were in position at the bottom, arms folded, legs splayed wide, two handsome, towering, scarred, immortal bouncers. The nine were home. I basked in the simple pleasure of that fact for a moment. Then my smile was obliterated by a scowl. They were guarding the same notorious staircase from which the notorious Riordan used to give his notorious nod every morning. Now, I knew the legend. Women never refused. Saw. Off. Head. I dragged my gaze from the stairs and continued scanning the club. Hundreds of laborers mulled about the interior, dismantling bars and snugs, prepping for renovations. I was pleased to see the kiddie sub-club was already demolished. I couldn't look at it without thinking of Joe. Apparently Riordan couldn't either. Nor, I'd bet, did Lore much like it anymore. Besides, it reminded me, too, of that day Riordan had saved my life by shoving me on an elevator, sacrificing himself to fling my cabled car up to safety. I'd thanked him by slaughtering everyone in the kiddie subclub while he was out of commission. Done it to deliberately wreck his good name with the patrons he'd guaranteed safety within his walls. I'd endangered his chessboard. No wonder he'd been so angry with me.
I'd nearly cost him the information that gave him the ability to control the Nine's world, affect the world beyond it. God, it seemed so long ago. It was a vastly different time. A vastly different me. I'd believed myself large and in charge in my teens, and I'd been out of control, indulging my desires without once considering their potential consequences. Here in Chester's, I'd had a brutal epiphany at 14. Come to understand, my actions had ramifications. I'd glimpsed, for the first time, the boats I'd left capsized in my wake, occupants flailing in the water as I blasted across the white caps of Dublin's stormy sea. I stood a moment, letting memories wash over me, then shook them briskly off. I was glad to see the club reopening. I was not, however, glad to see its erstwhile owner. I narrowed my eyes as I realized I didn't see its erstwhile owner. Anywhere. Where was he? I had a bone the size of a Patago Titan's femur to pick with him. My hands were so tightly fisted, the nails of my right hand had drawn blood. My gloved left was cold as ice and itching ferociously. As I pushed forward through the open doors, I felt them fall in behind me, one on each side. I didn't even need to turn around. Two of the Nine had been standing behind the doors on either side, and I'd not sensed them through the foot-thick steel that I was willing to bet was coated with the mysterious alloy Riordan likes to use. I certainly felt them now, an exhilarating electrical charge sizzling on every inch of my skin. But there was something more. Something disturbing. That thrilling current was laced with a thing I'd not noticed when I was younger. A slow, dark, blatantly sexual burn. They radiated masculinity, saturated the air with a palpable, primal earthiness, a promise of inexhaustible carnality. Unlike the Fae's brutal assault on the senses, there was no compulsion here. They simply exuded erotic invitation and promise, awakening in a woman's body a profound, inescapable awareness that an eminently fuckable man was near that could deliver the kind of sex women dream of. Mind-blowing, earth-shattering, all-consuming, go down in history as the best ever. And all I could think was, holy distorting diode, please tell me Riordan doesn't throw this charge off now too. Had something about them changed? Or was something about me different? Was this what Joe had always felt around Riordan? What other women had incessantly experienced around the Nine? Had I just been too young, too sexually inexperienced, too full of myself to feel it back then? Possible. I turned to see who flanked me. On my left was the one I call Shadow, as I've never learned his name. Scarred and massive, towering over me by a foot, whiskey eyes burning, he watched me in silence. To my right was, holy hell, Lore! The rubber bands stringing my muscles too tight vanished, and my face exploded in a 100-megawatt smile. I flung myself into the tall blonde man's arms, and was rewarded with an enormous crushing bear hug as the ever-up-for-a-party Viking swept me off my feet and spun me round. When he finally put me back down, I was still grinning like an idiot, until he flashed me a wolfish smile and said,
"Honey, you've been running my ass ragged for 2 goddamn eternal years. I'm so fucking glad the boss is back. Might have time to get laid again."
My smile vanished. Wait, what?
Laid. I might get laid.
I heard that part. That's a given with you. I don't need to hear it. 2 years? Running your ass ragged?
Watching you. Making sure you stayed out of trouble.
I strained every tendon in my right hand by fisting it too tightly. You've been here, in Dublin, for 2 years? Right here? He nodded happily.
Thought I was going to have to save you from those slimy bastards the other night, but you took care of them just fine, honey.
It wasn't penetrating for some reason, probably because the thought was so odious I was barring it entrance to my mind. Let me get this straight.